In for Sean Pendergast this morning. I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, man. 713-572-4610. You can text the show. You've piqued a lot of people's interest in the unclaimed funds website, Seth.
Go to claimittexas.gov and see the riches that await for you. I've got about $150 in unclaimed funds, it turns out, in Texas right now, dating back to 2006. I've got nationwide insurance rebate. I've got something from Morgan Stanley, and then I've got something from the state of Missouri, which I'm guessing comes from when I was a Texans player. You have to pay out of state. You have to pay state income tax in the various states that you play in. So for a Chiefs game, I probably got some kind of a tax refund there. And it's such a nice way to celebrate the 4th of July. If you realize you've got like $150 out there, all you have to do is claim. Now I got to go back and find out proof that I lived in that at that address.
I was getting very excited that I might have something in here, and I was asking you about like the tax situation. You have to pay taxes on this if you claim it, and you know it depends on what you're claiming. But my name's not even showing up, man. Like literally everybody in my family pulls up. And they have riches that await them, Sean Bajani does not.
Yeah, but then you get to tell your family members. Then you get to be the bearer of good news. Mm. You're staying with your family right now for your grandma's 80th birthday party, right?
I am. Does she have the shirt?
Yeah, happy birthday, Grandma. Here's a link to you to go claim $77. And some savings bond from way back in the day or something.
Yeah,
yes.
And spend it on some scratch-offs and maybe get tenfold back coming to you.
Thanks a lot, Captain Buzzkill, for bringing up the taxes on it. I don't know if – I don't think – everything that I'm seeing here would have already been in a tax document. Like some – the $35 from Morgan Stanley that I'm waiting on, I'm guessing it was on the tax form in 2011. So I'm sure I already paid taxes on it. I never collected the actual money.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. We're going to have to sift through this later on today. I know what I'm doing later today, poolside, when I get back to the house.
We did. No, our listeners, somebody listening right now is going to do it and get like $700 back. Every time we bring this up, somebody has a great story about
it. Text in 713-572-4610. Let us know what you find out, man. Good luck to you all. I literally learned something today. I did not know this was a thing. I'm very excited about this. At least not for me, but for my family.
Yeah, and the sports side of that, everybody, if you weren't listening, was that the Browns are going to use, was it $600 million in Ohio
unclaimed funds? $600 million.
So I don't know if the Texans are going to pull that tactic, then they might be going after stuff. You gotta get in on it now while it's hot, Dan.
I thought about something that you'd said yesterday. We were talking about, I don't even know how it came up, but maybe it was last offseason, right, when the Texans brought in Stephon Diggs. And we're maybe having these conversations like, man, Nico Collins, Stephon Diggs, Tank Dell, 3 1,000-plus-yard receivers. What would that look like? How cool would that be? I think it'd be the first time it would happen in the NFL, I don't know, in like 15 years, something like that, and maybe the fourth or fifth time ever in the history. It didn't happen, of course, but you'd said something like, yeah, in so many words, like careful what you wish for, like that maybe means like you're weaker in other areas. It's not all that it's cracked up to be kind of a thing, right?
Yeah. It's not like to just the vast majority of really good offenses don't have 3,000-yard receivers.
Yeah.
So it's not like some benchmark that you got to reach to show that you're good. I would have much preferred having 2,000-yard receivers and, Joe Mixon going for 1,500 yards or something like that, more so than just trying to be so pass happy.
Well, I started thinking about it from a Texan perspective this season, right, with Nico Collins, Christian Kirk, and insert others, right? Like, who's that third guy going to end up being that steps up? And I guess for sake of conversation, we can include Dalton Schultz here. I mean, he's a pass catcher, right? Tight end position. So we'll not expand beyond that. But I thought about a guy who the Texans drafted this offseason, Jalen Knoll out of Iowa State. He was taken third round, 79th overall, and a lot of the stuff that I was reading, you know, said that he was expected to be taken sooner than that. Like in the second round is where he was being mocked to go leading into the draft. And I'm like, man, at the end of the day, season, could the Texans look at this as like a draft steal and maybe one of the biggest or the biggest draft steal in their franchise's history? And I'm not saying that to be like, wow, boom, like headline here. You know, look at this story. Like, you look back, Seth, at who the Texans have drafted at receiver in their history. There's not one receiver that they drafted outside of the first round in rounds 2 through 7 that has ever had a season in which they've caught more than 800 yards. Tank Dell got close. Tank Dell got close. He was like 792. But they've not had a drafted wide receiver outside of the first round that has had a season in which they've caught 1,000 or more yards.
What about Nico?
Outside, well, okay, Nico Collins, he was third round, right?
Yeah.
I was going to exclude Nico Collins for the sake of the conversation. Like, he's here, he's proven, he's a guy. But, like, outside of Nico Collins, you know, Andre Johnson, DeAndre Hopkins, you know, like, those guys were early round picks. Will Fuller as well. Nico Collins.
Yeah. You know what? I'm glad. It's a really good point, though, too, because even if you include Nico Collins in the conversation before he had his 1,000-yard seasons, it shows how much if you look at Aaron Rodgers when he was in Green Bay, Aaron Rodgers was part of turning a lot of non-first-round wide receivers into really good wide receivers. The quarterback really matters, but then also the organization's ability to find guys like Devontae Adams and what have you. That's where – you know, Nico wasn't the guy he is now until he started catching passes from C.J. Stroud.
Hopefully
that's the difference with Jalen Nowell, perhaps. You know,
before
Andre Johnson and DeAndre Hopkins were great receivers, regardless of who threw the ball to him, other than Brock Osweiler.
Yeah,
that was the only
guy
that couldn't throw to DeAndre Hopkins. But this is now you're in a dynamic where you have the potential to have a quarterback turn guys into better wide receivers.
So the Texans have drafted 10 receivers in rounds 2 and 3 all time. Only one of them has had a 1,000-yard season, and that's Nico Collins, right? But looking back in the history from Jabbar Gaffney in 2002, Sloan Thomas, Jerome Mathis, Jacoby Jones, Doran Dickerson. You see where I'm going with this. Like, you remember, there's a lot of these guys. Kiki QT, remember what we thought he could be? Remember Jalen Strong, what we thought he could be? Braxton Miller. And now, you know, into present day, John Metchie, Xavier Hutchinson, like Tank Dell. Tank Dell's best season, 2023, 709 yards. Kiki QT's best season, 2018, 400 yards. Jacoby Jones, if I told you his best season with the Houston Texans as a receiver, he caught 562 yards worth of passes. What would you say? Like, as a legitimate, like, you know, number two, number three receiver next to, you know, Andre Johnson, would you think it would be more or less?
Wait, what would I say about what?
If I told you Jacoby Jones' best season with the Texans had him catching 562 yards,
yeah,
would you have expected it to be more or less?
I would. That sounds about right.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
And that's the best season they've ever had. So between Jaden Higgins.
That's the best that any of those guys have ever had?
Well, Jacoby, nobody's ever had, you know, the 1,000-yard season that Nico's had. They've all been, until Tank Dell, Tank Dell's the best. Tank Dell's the best outside of Nico Collins, 709 yards in a season. And he's not going to play this year, presumably. So Jaden Higgins, Jalen Nowell, second and third round picks, respectively, at the end of the season, at the end of the rookie contract, are we going to be looking back and asking, man, were those two guys, maybe both, some of the biggest steals and slash the most productive non-first-round wide receivers taken by the Texans?
You know what? I don't know about at the end of this season. That's where it gets interesting is how are all the targets divvied up this year? I think I would prefer, honestly, that if I had to choose between Woody Marks having a huge rookie year or Jalen Nowell having a huge rookie year, I think I'd go with Woody Marks because it's more balanced. So with Jalen Nowell, I'm very excited about him, but he's got a veteran slot receiver in front of him to get a lot of the slot reps, and I think it's going to be Christian Kirk early on. And then with Jaden Higgins is the biggest X factor where I could see if he really takes advantage of teams focusing their attention on Nico Collins, then he might have some really huge breakout performances. I think Jalen Knoll, we're going to see a game or two where he has 150 yards receiving on like two huge strikes, but it won't necessarily be the same steady diet as Jaden Higgins. But at the end of the first, at the end of their contracts or the end of the first few years, I'm really optimistic about both these guys. And one of them with Jalen Knoll, and actually Jaden Higgins every year I've watched with him. This is Jalen Knoll. I don't know if you've heard this yet or not, Sean.
No, I haven't.
This is Jalen Knoll when he was on the Amon-Ra Brothers podcast talking about what his first big purchase was with all that signing bonus money.
So with this signing bonus that you're getting, what's your first purchase? Like, what's your first big purchase?
Oh, man. If I don't get like a furniture deal or something, I'm going to get some nice furniture.
Okay.
Furnish the crib.
So you're getting a crib, though? You're buying a crib?
Renting. I won't buy until a second contract.
Right.
But yeah, I guess crib go into it, some furniture.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep my little Toyota Camry for
You got a Toyota Camry?
Yeah, 2021 red interior. So, it's good enough.
I like that. That'd be tough.
He's got a Camry. He's driving a Camry, Sean, and he's keeping his Camry. This is a guy with a head. He's got his head on his shoulders. He has, because you know, if he bought the Camry with the red interior, that was probably some NIL money involved. So it's probably a nicer Camry.
Yeah.
But he's got no need to upgrade right now. I love rookies who sound like they're way more mature than I am. And it makes you feel good about them being in the right environment and having the right resources and a good quarterback to throw them the football. I'll take that. I raise my 40 time allowance like 1/10 of a second if I hear quotes like that out of a prospect.
Somebody.
I'll take him. And he's plenty fast, don't get me wrong. I'll take him over a guy who might look a little bit more physically talented, but is already somehow 3 days after the draft, like $4 million in debt. Yeah, give me that.
A 2021 Camry with a red interior. It can't be like all red. Somebody on the text line said, red interior, that's tacky. It can't be like all red. Like, it's 2021, right?
That's the beauty of it. If it's all red, I'm guessing it's got red accents or something.
That's what I was thinking,
I don't know.
Too.
I hope it's red leather, because that's where the you still get the spiciness that you want in a receiver, but it's restrained. It's a restrained spiciness. Just like DeAndre Hopkins and Andre Johnson had, a restrained spiciness.
Yeah, that's fair. Somebody texted in from the 346. What about Kevin Walter? As it pertains to
draft pick of the Texans.
He was not a draft pick, and they caught themselves.
Nor was Brandon Cooks. Yeah, that's what. No, I went through the same as you were talking about it. I was like, well, yeah, what about Kevin Walter? Oh, yeah.
All right. It didn't sound right, did it? It didn't sound right because you're thinking, like, well, hold on. The Texans never drafted a guy that is, you know, outside of Nico Collins, had a season of 1,000 or more yards that was not named DeAndre Hopkins and Andre Johnson. Come on, that can't be true. Oh, it's true. And that's what fascinates me about the stage in which we are in right now with the Houston Texans in their franchise's history, where you see all these great, big, bright, shiny toys that you've got the head coach and a quarterback and the cornerstone of the defense and these receivers, these weapons, all this stuff, and you're going out and you're having these big-time free agent acquisitions and signings or trades, whatever. Yeah, we have freaking Danielle Hunter and Joe Mixon, you know, on this team. That's just wild to me. And now we're talking about like an era of Texans football that has never existed before. Like, you're going to start hitting on wide receivers all of a sudden? You're going to start hitting on offensive linemen all of a sudden? Like, when did this happen? Never. It's just pretty wild. Like, just something to consider. Like, hey, this has never happened before. Looking at you, Nick Caserio, D'Amico Ryans, like, you got an opportunity to make franchise history in your trek to the Super Bowl.
The all-time, it's fun when you go down to just the all-time single season records for the Texans, and just like the Andre and DeAndre are the top 10 in terms of number of receptions. For some reason, this isn't giving me yards. Oh, there we go, yards. It's Andre DeAndre, all the way until you get down number eight for Nico Collins, and then it's back to Andre DeAndre. And the first round wide receivers have been good to us. There like most of the really good offenses have guys that are also producing who aren't first round receivers or Nico Collins. Like, Nico might as well be your first rounder on this squad, obviously. And with what teams have done with second and third round receivers over the last decade, This draft here feels more like some of those old drafts. They got like some of those draft picks where Jaden Higgins, man, it totally would have made sense for him to be a first rounder. Jalen Noel, you get the size dynamic, but that's a guy that a lot of people had slotted in the second round. I think they're most potential to have guys paired with a good quarterback and get those kinds of performances that the Texans have never historically gotten. Yeah, that's they're primed for it right now.
Texture from the 832, Tank Dell wasn't the best. It was Will Fuller based on yards. Will Fuller was a first-round draft pick. I'm talking about like guys not drafted in the first round, specifically rounds two and below. You know, the most productive receiver in terms of yards and really just the whole bit, but certainly yards, it's been Tank Dell. It's been Tank Dell, and that was the 2023 season, 709 yards. And maybe it's Jaden Higgins and Jalen Noel. That's the question. Something to think about from a historical perspective with the Texans. A lot of people know their cars on the text line. 2021 Camry XSE. That interior is sweet. Red is for the Iowa State colors, by the way. So forgot about that. It's probably Iowa State. Maybe it's a little red and yellow interior. He could kind of swap the yellow for a little deep steel blue action if you're Jalen Noel. I would co-sign that. 713-572-4610 if you want to continue to weigh in, be a part of the conversation. We'll roll with some more Texans, get you caught up on some of the other off-season topics. He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. It's Sports Radio 610. Stay put. Welcome back in. Good morning, everybody. Sports Radio 610 in for Sean Pendergast. I'm Sean Bajani. He's Seth Payne. Hit us up, 713-572-4610 if you want to text. And a lot of text on the conversation we just had about the second and third round and so on and so forth receivers in Texans draft history. A lot of really good suggestions, people catching themselves like, boy, I thought this guy, and oh, you're talking about like non-first round picks. Yeah, a lot of Will Fullers, a lot of Kevin Walters, who was not drafted by the Texans, but rather the Bengals. We got a lot of, they had some good Texan seasons now. The Texans have had free agent acquisitions that have put up some good numbers, like Kevin Walter did. He had like back-to-back 800-plus yard seasons with the Texans, his first 2 years with them, in fact, since coming over from the Bengals, but not drafted.
Yeah, and then the people suggesting Will Fuller was the most curious one because like he, I think people have forgotten that he was a first round pick. Nico, because I think DeAndre Hopkins kind of set the bar for what you could do with the second half of the first round type of guy that they forget. They're like, oh yeah, Will Fuller was one of those guys too.
Okay. Yeah, Stephen James on YouTube says Nico was the best number two receiver. He was a third round pick and hasn't been considered the number one receiver until now. I mean, wouldn't you have considered him the number one receiver going into last season? I mean, I know you had
that was a big topic of debate. No, I think I remember, if you're being honest with yourself, last year there was a lot of debate about like, okay, who's the Texans' number one wide receiver? And I hate those debates because it's genuinely a game plan by game plan thing when you have a couple of a good wide receivers or two or three good wide receivers. But I think that was that's fair. I think we're now it's clear cut that he's your number one wide receiver, the most important guy.
Yeah. Not up for conversation anymore like it was last year, I guess. But to me, gun to my head, I would have still said, and I probably did say Nico over Stephon, you know, even coming into last year, like number one receiver. Like, all right, at the end of the season, who's going to be like who's going to be your leading scorer in basketball, right, for the Rockets? It's going to be Kevin Durant this year, right? He's going to be your number one scoring option, right? Who's going to be your number one target last year, even with Stephon Diggs and Tank Dell? It's probably going to be Nico Collins. Like, maybe we're splitting hairs, but I would have at least said Nico. Definitely saying Nico now. I saw this yesterday, and you had a chance to really pull some really good cuts from Ari Mirov on Twitter. He covers the NFL for 33rd Team. He had a Texans assistant general manager on his NFL Spotlight show yesterday, Chris Blanco. Yeah. And you're going to play a cut here that is talking about how the Texans have been able to build around CJ.
So Chris Blanco, the assistant GM who's elevated to that position this offseason, was asked about how do they build a team around CJ Stroud, a young guy on his rookie contract. And He didn't answer the question, like, I think, in necessarily the way that Ari Myrov expected him to.
Yeah.
But I liked the answer a lot.
Yeah, I think the best thing about Nick and D'Amico when they build a roster, it's never solely focused on one player, be it the quarterback, a pass rusher, wide receiver, et cetera. It's really about bringing in highly competitive football players who are physically, mentally tough, you know, who have a level of aggression in the way that they play. And okay. We're good people in the locker room.
Forgot about that last part. That was important too.
Yeah.
The part having a level of aggression with how they play. I like this coming from Chris Blanco because so much of the conversation they had in this interview was about analytics and the math side of things. And I just, one thing I've always admired about the Astros is that they're a heavily analytically based organization. But they tend to also find these guys that just seem like genuinely solid citizens, like as baseball players, that are just all about baseball, like the Alex Bregman type of nerdiness, where he's just obsessed with baseball. I think that Caserio and D'Amico have really gotten to a good spot where they know how to identify actual football passion and actual football toughness. There have been other coaches in the past with the Texans where I feel like they wanted high football character, but I don't know if they could identify it. They would get guys that were, you know, like good, solid dudes. They had high GPA in college and all this, that come from strong families, all that. But I question just how passionate they were about football. I think these last 2 years, and I think D'Amico's been the big difference, is that D'Amico has a really good ability to identify, all right, these are the guys that might fit what we're looking for in terms of the physical measurables, but how does he play football? Like, can I see it on the film that this guy as a defensive player has a bloodlust about him? And
yeah.
Has like, okay, he's awesome guy, but also does he have that dark side to him? I think they've done a really good job of identifying those guys. And I like it. It's as the Texans are becoming one of the more analytically based organizations as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. I have a lot of questions now. It's something I never think of. Like, what's the role of an assistant general manager? You know, I would imagine, you know, to varying degrees, it differs from organization to organization, dependent upon, like, you know, like who they're going to employ beyond like GM, assistant GM, scouting department, you know, how into data analytics are NFL teams really? Like, I'm curious, like just from a Texan perspective, like Chris Blanco's role, like what exactly is that and does it need to be to Nick Caserio?
Well, he talked about that in the interview and a lot of it was, it sounded very New England-like, the way that Belichick would operate things.
Yeah.
It's less about the title and more about the role and exactly what you're going to do.
Yeah.
So he's a guy that went to law school and had a passion for like math and baseball stats from an early age, from the time he was 8 or 9 years old, was working on Excel spreadsheets when he was 9 years old.
Yeah.
That type of dude. So at the same time, though, he also played football in college and everything. He has that background. But he very much learned the analytical side of it with the Texans starting back in, I think his first year with the Texans was in 2013 or before that.
Mm-hmm.
But then also went off to Minnesota where they're very, very heavily analytical and learned a lot up there. So like his role, I'm guessing, is a lot on the analytics side and
yeah.
Balancing out like how are you handling a lot of the stuff that they're doing with these contracts where the Texans are operating a little bit differently than other teams, just being really aggressive with guaranteed money, all of this other stuff.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's that type of stuff that Nick really likes about a guy that doesn't fit the classic, you know, ex-jock mode. He's much more, and having that blend, just like the Astros did, where I think they've done a great job of getting old school baseball people who have a respect for the analytical side of things, but also the analytical people in the Astros organization understand that the actual baseball knowledge really matters. So
yes,
like how do you
yes.
combine those two things together? That's always the challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Not as easy as it sounds, as you think it would be. We're going to hear more from Chris Blanco coming up in about an hour on Sports Radio 610. Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast this morning. Something that Blanco did say, though, towards the end of that cut, at the very end of that cut, in fact, was you were like, well, that was kind of important, too, talking about the players that they bring in and are evaluating. They need to be good guys as well. And it's interesting because the characters, the personalities, the kind of guys that, you know, are in the Texans locker room now are maybe not necessarily, you know, players that they would have taken a chance on 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of
Damon Arnett, especially, I think, you know, he's 100%. Arnett, he's got a long litany of legal issues and everything in the past. For one, I think that's like Nickel always say, that's a get him in the building type of scenario.
Yeah.
But the important thing he said was that they're good guys in the locker room.
Yeah.
And that's always a big test. It's that, you know, Damon Arnett may have just not got nothing but glowing reports about the way he was to his teammates and everything else. He might have a whole bunch of issues outside of the football facility, but though we've seen it can work with guys like that if they get, if they figure it out and, you know, start walking down the proper path. But if they're just jerks in the locker room, that's where it makes it really tough to justify having them around. So I think that again, back in the past, sometimes I think when they were looking at character, they're almost looking at it the same way you might look at, you know, bringing somebody into a Fortune 500 company or something, where it's just, it's different in football.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a, this guy, does this guy fit on a football team? Does he a good dude in the locker room?
Well, you know, we had on Area 45, me and Patrick, all season long, we had CJ Johnson, head coach of the Houston Roughnecks, on with us once a week. And we even had Damon Arnett on our show. And on back-to-back weeks, I remember because Arnett had like a pick six, and I asked CJ about that and, you know, what kind of player he was. Never mind, like it was not, you know, something at the forefront of my mind at the time. Like, hey, you know, let me ask CJ about like Damon's past because I'd forgotten about it. And, you know, being a 2020 Raider draft pick, it's not something that I'm necessarily concerned with. I don't know why he's not in the league anymore. I'm not worried about that. I just know he had a really good game. And so I asked CJ about that, and I'll never forget, CJ earlier this season was talking about like exactly what you asked a question about, like, well, what kind of locker room guy is he? And he, Damon Arnett was one of their leaders, one of their guys that was very much by action in the way that he worked, very much by, you know, their words as well. Like, he was very much a rah-rah guy, you know, pick your head up kind of a thing. They're in the heart of a playoff race. The Roughnecks were this season. And so I think that bodes well. And it may be compounded by the fact, I don't know if it matters or not, but, I mean, CJ's just down the street, right, in the same city with D'Amico Ryans. I mean, they have an easy way of going about getting to know the player from somebody that sees him and has coached him and maybe mentored him on a day-in and day-out basis.
You know what, the if we're talking about like colorful personalities and everything, I'm reading Belichick's book right now, and it started off slow. The first couple chapters, I thought, this is I'm not gonna lie. He loosens up and he starts telling more stories as it goes along. But Antonio Brown was an interesting. Since we're talking about being a good football teammate and everything,
Antonio Brown was interesting. Yeah, let me hear this.
Yeah, but look, they took a flyer on Antonio Brown. It ended up working out in Tampa, obviously, for a while. But there was Antonio Brown had gotten Tom Brady a gift, and it was this special, some kind of special milk, like some kind of protein shake or something. Belichick's calling it milk. I don't know if it was actual yak's milk or something, but it was super, super expensive stuff, like several thousand dollars. And Antonio had it sent to Tom Brady as a gift, but it arrived like on a Friday afternoon and then sat in Tom Brady's locker all night and ended up spoiling and ended up being kind of a big deal before. Like Belichick is having to put in a reimbursement request to the front office because Antonio Brown sounds like was pretty livid about the fact that they had botched this milk delivery for Tom Brady. So that's where the extreme talent part comes in. Well, everything we're saying is true, except that also Antonio Brown did work really hard, and he was kind of a nut job. But when you're one of the best receivers who ever lived, you gotta tweak things a little bit every now and then.
Yeah, you spend thousands of dollars on some kind of exotic milk. It's just going to sit and spoil in somebody's nasty, sweaty locker. Yeah, I'd be pretty ticked off about that, too. Especially maybe Antonio Brown, who's had some financial difficulty, I think, in recent years. Did he or did he not file for bankruptcy? I think in the last year.
Yeah, I did. I think he was in a situation where he still has income because he's got all his social media feeds.
Yeah.
So, but his debts were larger than what he could sustain. Yeah. Yeah. Mostly he just doesn't, whether he has money or not, he just doesn't like paying bills. So that's one of his big issues has been, you know, like just stiffing a private chef on over $10,000 worth of bills.
Or stiffing his players as owner of a, you know, alternative football league team.
Stiff that moving company. They were all upset about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Seth Payne and Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast this morning. Coming up next, talking about clubhouse culture. The Astros clubhouse culture, is it over or underrated? We'll discuss next. Stay put. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back in. Sports Radio 610's Payne and Pendergast. Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, 713-572-4610, 572-4610. You can text. You can join the chat as well on Twitch and YouTube. Chandler Rome wrote a recent piece in The Athletic talking about the Astros clubhouse culture. And I thought it was pretty interesting. It was really centric, written around Isak Paredes and how he's kind of assimilated himself into the Astros clubhouse culture. And I thought it was kind of interesting some of the things that Isak was telling Chandler about what things were going to be like whenever he gets dealt to Houston from Chicago as part of that Kyle Tucker trade. He's thinking that, boy, I'm going to a World Series contending team. They have a lot of really great players on the roster. What's it going to be like? He was intimidated by that. And here's the quote from Isak. At first in spring training, I thought it was going to be harder because you have all these superstars. So I thought it was going to be more strict. But it's the complete opposite. It's very relaxing. They've been very open. And that gives me the confidence to go out there and play ball. End quote from Isak.
Yeah, I guess, and immediately I think, okay, well, why is this welcoming attitude not working for Christian Walker? What is it? Are they being more welcoming of Paredes? And this is, can I blame the frosty welcome or something for Christian Walker being as bad as he is? That makes me feel worse about Christian Walker. Makes me feel great about Isak Paredes.
Yeah, well, it's a good point about Walker. You know, not all guys are created equal. It could be as warm and fuzzy as possible, but yeah, maybe Christian Walker needs it to be a little bit more, a little bit more rough around the edges, maybe all business. I don't know.
Yeah, he needs to go somewhere with just some genuine jerks on the roster or something.
Yeah,
yeah. That's one thing that Altuve has always said that and Altuve doesn't know what other major league clubhouses are like other than what other people tell him, but that they're just a lot more welcoming when guys come in, and that there's just kind of, they try to really make people feel at home and welcome and part of the team. Because there is that, when you go to a new team, sometimes you just kind of, you're tiptoeing around a little bit because you don't want to be the guy that just asserts himself too much as the new guy. And it sounds like the Astros are able to cut through a lot of that. But ultimately, for them to win the way they are winning this year, it's the culture is there, obviously. And a lot of that just starts with Altuve, or at least it's maintained through Altuve. But the culture of the organization and their ability to develop players and just not look at them when they're in the minors or even if they're already major league players as like that it's not set in stone, that there's still upside if you just actually work at it and develop them.
Yeah.
That's probably been the most impressive thing that's sustained them. I mean, the pitchers can all have great attitudes, but unless you're identifying guys like Fromber and like Javier, or like if we talk about just the guys that were discovered as older Latin American prospects and then working with them and developing them, that's been a big part of it this year, is that they've got so many pitchers that they're getting the best performances out of.
You know, you're talking about Christian Walker and Isak Paredes, one's worked for the other. Like Chandler Rome made a point in the article to say that, you know, Isak's been traded already before. Being traded from the Cubs to the Astros, you know, Isak at one point in time was a Detroit Tiger. So he's maybe a little bit more used to, you know, being accepted into a clubhouse. He was a Tiger. He's a Ray. He was a Cub. You know, this is not foreign territory to him. Well, it shouldn't be for Christian Walker either. Christian Walker, yeah, he'd spent a lot of years in Arizona, but that's not where he got his, you know, start in his career. He was a Baltimore Oriole for a couple of years. You know, he understands at various points in time in his career, you know, how tough it is or challenging it can be to kind of you know, be accepted into a new city, a new clubhouse. And to be quite honest with you, like, I know the Jose Abreu comparisons do exist, unfortunately, as we sit here in the month of July now between him and Christian Walker. But the one thing that I always latched onto, and I don't know that we ever got an answer, or certainly not even interested in now, but is why Jose Abreu did struggle his first year as an Astro, outside of maybe, yes, just the decline that we should have seen in the numbers. But, you know, he was in Chicago as a member of the White Sox for a long time. It's where he, you know, got his start, and it's where he saw his success. I wondered, like, if he coming to the Astros, you know, very much, you know, still at the peak, what we thought was of this dynastic run of them being on, if that was intimidating to him. Like, you're a White Sox. You're a member of an organization that has literally had zero expectations in large for the time that you'd spent there, outside of that one time when you had Tony La Russa and you thought, like, oh, well, this guy's going to bring a winning culture and, you know, kind of take you to the next level. No, that wasn't the case at all. It hits guys differently. And I think it clearly has for Christian Walker, for whatever reason, that he's not felt as comfortable as a Houston Astro with maybe all of those expectations that go along with a guy that's getting paid the same exact contract that Jose Abreu was.
That is interesting, especially if, you know, if Paredes is talking about how he was kind of intimidated just coming into this environment that's won so much, and you wonder if you're, yeah, there might just be as simple an element as pushing too hard. And yeah. Because Abreu, you had seen the decline in the power the year before, and it looked like, okay, yeah, this is a guy that's, he's in 2022, he was 35 years old. He's 36. There's going to continue to be a decline. Yeah. But the decline was so drastic. And with Abreu, he just, you could never fault him for his work ethic. He worked his butt off and he wanted to be out there playing every day. It might be as simple as that. It's one of those things that might be simple but impossible to fix, is just how hard he was pressing in the face of declining physical skills and trying to measure up to a new standard.
Yeah.
That it's a lot.
You know, one point that I want to make, I like to make this point because, you know, Joe Espada, I don't feel like gets near the credit that he deserves, even now that the ball club is winning and they're one of the best in the bigs, you know, to date, record wise and overperformance, maybe some would say, many would say maybe in terms of the results they're seeing from guys that you didn't even know existed maybe 3 months ago. But it's Jeremy Peña. And when Espada earlier this offseason, when we still didn't have finality with where Alex Bregman was going to wind up, is he going to be an Astro lifer? Is he going to wind up in Boston or Chicago? Who's he going to be playing for? Joe Espada was asked a question on MLB Network. Who's going to be the vocal leader? Who's going to be the clubhouse leader that kind of replaces an Alex Bregman that you're going to be missing so much from if, in fact, you can't retain him? He didn't mince words. He didn't hesitate. He didn't stutter. He said Jeremy Peña. And he said Jeremy Peña because he's seen over the years a guy that has understood Jose Altuve's here, Yordan Alvarez is here, Kyle Tucker's here, Alex Bregman is here. Those are the guys that are vocal and that lead by example. But he's wanting to be that guy. He's waiting for his opportunity. And it just so happened, it presented itself. You know, Yordan has struggled out of the gate and now hadn't played baseball for 2 months. Never mind, Bregman and Tucker are no longer Astros. Jeremy Peña is a guy at a premium position who is now performing and taking his game to a completely different level, who has thrived on the opportunity to be a clubhouse leader and be a more vocal guy who already brought an innate, you know, energy to him and the excitable personality that he plays the game with. I think those two things have gelled perfectly.
Yeah, and it's also, too, you know, sometimes I think we probably, people get too fixated on who's going to be the vocal leader and all of that. And yeah, we're on so many of the good teams, it's never, it doesn't have to be that there's one guy that's the driving force behind it. You know, think about those San Antonio Spurs rosters forever. And I think that's where the Astros have been. Like Correa, remember how awkward it was that Correa was all of a sudden so like visibly the leader in his free agency year. Yeah. Like all of a sudden Correa was like, hey, I'm going to be out at every mound visit and I'm going to be the guy. Like, all right, we get it. It's putting your best foot forward. It doesn't necessarily need to be that way. Mm-hmm. If you go back to 2017, there's some element of where you're bringing in, you've got a bunch of young players and a bunch of unprovens the way it's shaken out so far this year, but you have the veteran presence of Paredes, and it'd be nice if Christian Walker was playing better. But when they brought in McCann and all of those other guys, and right as the golden era was beginning, I like the blend of leadership or age and experience on this team.
Yeah. Texters, don't do this to yourselves. I'm telling you right now. We're getting some responses on the text line. 713-572-4610. Christian Walker had 3 hits last night. Maybe he's coming around.
We warned you about this.
Yeah.
I went through all the splits, man. Yeah. Any way you slice it or dice it, last 7 days, last 14 days, last 28 days, he's been a below average baseball player. And, yes, this could be the one that, this could be the game that everything turns around. But we've been through this before this year. I can't do this after every good Christian Walker performance.
Cross all the fingers, all the toes, the arm, whatever you need to cross. Like, maybe, but just let it breathe a little bit. Like, if he has, you know, 3 multi-hit games in this series in Colorado, like, I don't know that that's going to make me feel much better because
it's Colorado.
That's Colorado. Yeah. All right, what's the deal? If Punch and Judy hits, you know, if he's just, like, flaring balls over the shortstop or the second baseman's head, like,
yeah,
it's the Colorado thing, it's like, whatever, out the window, but still, it's also the exit velo. If he's popping balls over the infielder's heads at like 80 miles per hour.
Yeah, no, if he hits 3 home runs at 350 feet apiece or so, or plus, you know, pushing 400, then I'll be cool with that.
Yeah, just give us the results. I just need to get this win, too. I don't want to be talking about how the Rockies, you know, took 2 or 3 from the Astros. 9 o'clock hour is upon us at Sports Radio 610. He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani, and for Sean Pendergast. Stick with us at Sports Radio 610.